CRC.
Let me hand you the gavel. Here we're going to get going. The House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development will come to order. Welcome, everyone. We have a very full agenda, and just to kind of give everyone some idea of what we're going to do, we will take up the House Bill 3438 at a quarter after 2, and then we will discontinue taking testimony at about 12 minutes to 3, so that we have enough time in this committee to manage through a series of procedural matters. So we're going to carry over the House Bill 2331 on bicycle licensing to Monday. And let's see if there's anything else we're doing. Zach, is there anything else we need to do before we get started?
Good to go.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2202. Zach, would you read the summary and Vice Chair Beyer.
House Bill 2202 requires the State Department of Geology and Mineral Industries to conduct a study of geological opportunities within Oregon and present to the Legislative Assembly.
Thank you. Well, it's good to have you join us today, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Co-Vice Chair. Cliff Bentz, State Representative, District 60, appearing in support of House Bill 2202-2. And I'm joined today by Vicki McConnell, the Director of Dogami. The purpose of the bill is to suggest that we in Oregon determine the nature and extent of our mineral resources. I found in trying to determine what we actually had available in Oregon that the last review appeared to have been done back in the 80s and was not done with any particular detail. So as the handout I have provided illustrates, it would be a good idea for us to find out what exactly it is that we have in our state that's available, particularly given the challenges posed by other countries locking up their resources. We have some general idea of what's in Oregon, but it would be better if we actually knew. We could decide after we knew whether or not we're going to make use of them. And with that, I would ask that the director maybe share her thoughts on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And I thank both co-chairs for inviting us here today discussion of this bill, House Bill 2202. Just as a little bit of background, in case you may not be, this particular committee may not be as familiar with this agency as other committees are. Dogami, as we're called in our acronym, was formed in 1937, and it was primarily to provide geoscience data and assistance to rural economic development, right directly after the Depression, and looking at ways that we could look at natural resource assessments and potential in the state. Since then, we've added a lot of other responsibilities, and looking at developing these type of resource assessments have not been one of our primary missions or goals, although it is still something that we're interested in and is statutorily something that we are expected to do. I believe that Representative Bentz gave you a good background on really, again, we're fact-based. It's always good to know what you have and what is out there so that you can make informed decisions about what you may or may not want to do about that, and that certainly is true with resources that we have in the state as well. So my testimony really goes through some of the factual information. Right now, mining in the state represents about 0.1% of the GDP of the state, and so that it's not one of the bigger resource assessments with that, or natural resources that we work with in the state. We do have a variety of materials out there that we know through general mapping and some of our older resource assessments. And really, to be able to understand or develop more, you have to go back out and, like with any science, collect data, do the field work, do your homework, do the science that you would need to determine what those potentials are. And the return on investment of anything like that is really is the bringing of the interest. Is there something that is interesting enough and has the potential to be an investment for the states for resource extraction? So in order to accomplish that, there I have given at the bottom of the testimony a menu of what the cost would be for those types of investments, and those were based on several discussions we had on whether those resource assessments would be a report back to this legislature and made available to the public every biennium, every third biennium, or every 5 years or every decade. And right now the Dash 2 is actually looking at every 5 years. That would be some detailed mapping, some new data collection, looking at the trends that we have both in the state and where the needs for minerals and resources are globally, and providing detailed reports back to the legislature and again made available. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions or comments about where we are with this bill.
Thank you, Director. Are there questions? President Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Somebody shortened my seat. I'm shorter than Representative Beyer.
I didn't.
The rare earth elements actually intrigue me a little bit, because this is something I know Idaho's hit on, and there are some huge reserves there. And I'm just wondering if there's any estimate of where we would be at on any of the rare earth, because magnets are being used in a lot of things, especially as we start going to electrical vehicles and issues like that. So I'm just wondering, has there been any sort of study done to have an idea if we might have a lot of the rare earth elements here in the state of Oregon?
Co-chairs and Representative Wiedner, we have a general geologic understanding that we have potential for some of the rare earth elements, mainly in southeast, in the geology in the southeastern part of the state, and perhaps a little bit in the northeastern part of the state in some of our exotic terrains. And you do not want me to start telling you about those types of things right now. But the potential in Idaho is in a very different geologic setting, provenance, and we don't have that particular setting in the amount of coverage that they do. So in general, their potential is higher. That said, we do have, and again, I can't give you any type of resource potential numbers because we have not done the background data to really collect that. But we do have some potential for it. Uranium, tantalum, lithium, in particular, and tellurium. And those are ones, particularly lithium, which is for interest for lithium batteries.
Further questions? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. By exotic terrains, what do you mean?
Excuse me, the exotic.
By exotic terrains, what do you mean?
Co-chairs and Representative Smith, we have in Oregon, in both the northeast part of the state, in the Wallowa Mountain area, in the Baker area, and in the southwestern part of the state, in Jackson and Josephine counties, they are ancient land terrains that actually moved across the Pacific Ocean on subducting plates and welded themselves onto the North American plates. So they actually, we call them exotic because they came from somewhere else, but we now claim them in Oregon because this happened 240 million years ago. So those particular geologies have different materials and different resources than you see in, say, the middle part of the state, where we have primarily basalts and old marine sediments. That's the short answer.
All right. Thanks. Looking over the bill, there was an interval of review. How frequently would our landscape of, you know, mineral deposits, geological deposits, change? You know, it seems to me if there's something buried, it's going to be buried for a while. I could also imagine, what do I know? Or the reason it needs to be updated is because it'll encourage us to continue to look, and that's why it'll be changed. Talk a little about the interval.
Great. Co-chairs and Representative Smith, that's a good question. The geology at the surface of the Earth generally only changes when things like volcanic eruptions occur, where you're getting new material coming out. So, no, we're not getting, you know, as we speak in our little short time frame, we are not getting new geology happening. What we are doing are improving our ability to be able to find what we call the buried or more or less unknown materials that aren't sitting right there at the surface. The easy stuff gets extracted first, of course. So, for example, if you have precious metal, gold veins, etc., it's the placer, the deposits that are in the creeks, and it's deposits you can follow back up the creeks. But that doesn't mean that there aren't more capabilities if you understand in more detail the full geology of the area. So it's really looking at advanced geophysics and advanced geochemical work that we didn't have the capabilities of even 50 years ago.
Final thought?
If we can, just to remind everyone, we have about 7 bills to get through in about 40 minutes. So very short question, very short answer.
Yeah, and you can give the answer offline if you want. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Have we contemplated doing any overlay of not only where stuff is, but also where stuff is compared to where sensitive or less sensitive areas are for exploration, right? You know, for and I don't know, you know, there are surgeries that are to explore that are still surgeries, mm-hmm. right? And there are surgeries that when you find you want to remove something, it'll really matter. Mm-hmm. So have we thought about that? Have we thought about if there's some limitation to where we want to look?
Again, co-chairs and Representative Smith, and we can certainly talk about this in more detail, but that's all part of all of those type of information come into play. If you go from where we do the simple resource assessments that are available information to whether it would be in the private sector and interest in actually investing in that as an extraction, those are the questions that would have to be answered.
Okay, thanks.
Further questions? Yes,
President White. More of a comment. Will we be bringing this back to committee, because this is something that actually interests me and I think is something we really need to look into deeper?
We may.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions, comments? Thank you very, very much. Then I'm going to close the public hearing on 2202 and open the public hearing on 3227. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bentz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42 in Inner East Side, Portland. Sounds like you have a lot of bills before you today, so I'll keep it brief, although I was hoping to maybe give just a scattershot of opinions across all the different bills that you have here, but I will confine it to 3227 today.
Thank you very much.
Although it sounds like you got some interesting ones. To be brief and to sum up, I believe that 3227 could be an interesting part and a puzzle piece in the Betsy discussion that this committee has been having and is continuing to have, and I'm sure we will see throughout the rest of this session. Essentially, what 3227 is a way to think about how to leverage additional private investment in clean energy in a way that takes advantage of the enormous pool of private capital that's out there in this state. What 3227 does is it creates a concept called essentially a certified capital company. And what this certified capital company does is, you can think of this as, for example, an insurance company. It need not necessarily be limited to an insurance company, but an entity that has a large pool of investment capital that it is holding and making investments with in the insurance company's example, to pay out claims or to have that sort of rotating pool of capital. What a certified capital company is we're saying, okay, well, whereas before you had this large pool of capital that you're taking a portion of and you're essentially investing in capital markets in sort of a safe investment that has a very low rate of return, it's sort of a patient capital investment, bond markets, and those sorts of things. If you take a portion of that and instead you invest through, say, a VC fund that's having investments, whether it's equity investments or debt investments, in a clean energy project or business in the state of Oregon, then we're going to help you offset the risk differential on that change between the bond investment and the VC investment. So what essentially you're getting is for the tax credit investment that you're paying through the certified capital company model, you're leveraging that private investment that is often an equity investment, although it could be a debt debt contract, in a clean energy project, and you're only paying for the risk differential between the patient capital investment and then the clean energy VC fund investment. So you're not actually paying for the entire project in the way that you would with a tax credit that as has been done before through more of the traditional Betsy model, where there's a project and then a tax credit to offset the direct cost of that project. What this method does is it says we're going to pay just for the change on the margin in the return that you would get and the risk that you incur through an investment in some big global out-of-state investment fund and a local Oregon fund that has investments in clean energy. That's it. Now, you may hear from others who are testifying today about what are sometimes in shorthand referred to as CAPCO models in other states. What's proposed before you in 3227 is not really what other states have done in their larger CAPCO models, which tend to look at certified capital company investments across a broad array of businesses or investments. We're really focused in here on clean energy in 3227, which narrows the scope of it, makes these better investments, and really ensures that they're more directed at job creation and market development here in Oregon. But really what this is, I think, is a piece of the puzzle, perhaps, if we can get the policy right, around how we drive private investment into clean energy, how we keep some of that capital local here in Oregon, and how we're able to leverage to the greatest extent possible the private capital that we have in Oregon in order to further job creation through our clean energy future. It's a very complicated concept, I understand. I'd be happy to draw you many circles and diagrams and arrows and loops on my whiteboard at some point, but for now I'd be happy to take any questions.
Other questions for Representative Bailey? I just have one or two because this is a very complex device. I made my way about two-thirds of the way through it before I realized I probably needed to sit down with you and have you actually explain it. And it seemed to me that it was an extraordinarily interesting device and one that would require a couple of hours to actually get through adequately for us to understand it. Is that a correct understanding or correct statement of the nature of it, or was I just didn't take enough time?
Co-Chair Bence, you are correct. It is a complex instrument, but on the face of it, it's complex in how it's structured. It's simple in the concept, which is having a private capital that is available in-state to be invested locally in these kinds of businesses and clean energy projects, invested locally instead of invested in some global fund that's sending the dollars to who knows where.
Thank you. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. We have other folks signed up to talk about it.
Appreciate it.
And with that, if Jody Weiser, that's who signed up.
For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness, Oregon. So we are concerned about this bill. We do like the portion of the bill that focuses the investment into one part of our economy, and that hasn't been done much at all in other states, although some of the states have focused to much smaller companies than this bill does. Most of them, the states that have CAPCOs, focus them on businesses with 100 employees or less. As we read in the critique of the CAPCOs, if we were reading a piece of information provided by the investment firms that were making money off of these, or from the investor side, we heard glowing reports. But when we read things that were written by the legislative revenue offices of various states, we did not hear glowing reports. And, in fact, we heard pretty heavy criticism. A number of the states that started financing these programs have stopped financing them. They may have added in the first couple of years, and then they saw that this really wasn't working to their benefit. As I was looking actually for something else this morning, I came across an excellent study comparing two states' experiences with and without these kind of incentives. And there, basically, the Minnesota LRO office was trying to help their legislature understand a group of different bills that were brought before them that included everything from grants, which is really how our Betsy works. We know who we give money to. Our department chooses where our money would go, even though we give them tax credits. It operates like a grant program. And COPCOs, which operate more like whoever gets the door first gets the money. And there's little supervision of where the money goes with COPCOs. And Minnesota looked at their neighboring state, Wisconsin. Wisconsin has all sorts of programs, including a COPCO. And Minnesota has virtually none. One has a capital gains tax rate cut, the other doesn't. And what they found was that despite all these different tricks that Wisconsin was trying to play, they still did not have the kind of investment capital coming into their state or within their state as Minnesota had. Minnesota outstripped them, I think, all but 1 year, and that was the first year of their COPCO program. And Oregon is already doing the other thing that this paper went on to do was talk about the difference between a choice of by the legislature to do a grant-type program and the choice to do a tax credit program where you just whoever comes in the door gets it. And the study really suggests that when you do the basic tax credit program, that would be similar to our research and development tax program. We don't know who's using it. It's not available information even. And with things like our Betsy, we have people who are actually looking at what the investments are and trying to figure out which companies to invest in and which ones to let go and invested in. So far, since 2004, we've committed $110 million in Betsy research and development. We've committed to $168 million worth of manufacturing Betsys. And since 1999, we've committed to $119 of regular research and development tax credits and another $132 million worth of loans. So we have over $1 billion in various kinds of venture capital from angel to mature markets that we've done in the last 10 years. In addition to that, Business Oregon manages the Boosts and other loan programs. The Oregon Investment Fund, which is a sub-account of PERS, has invested $160 million in the state. The Oregon Growth Account, which is a sub-account of the Education Stabilization Fund, invests in Oregon. So there's lots of ways in which we're doing this. As we were looking around, one of the most interesting things we found was that in Maryland, they have a bill at this point in time before them that is very different from any other COPCO program in that it says, yes, the state will give you money if you bring some of your money to our state, but we will be an equal investment partner. We will get a return on our investment just like other venture capital investors get, rather than just saying, here's some money to help encourage you to invest in our state. And the bill that they have outlined is very equivalent to my experience as a venture capitalist. Usually the venture capitalist gets about 80% return on their investment. Might be nothing, because the investment might not be good, but if there's a good return, the investor gets 80%, and the managing company gets 20%. And Maryland's bill says if the state's investing, that's what they should do. I would urge you to look at that legislation and consider the kinds of changes to the COPCO program that are in Maryland's program if you go forward. Rutgers Professor Julie Rubin spoke against COPCO in Rhode Island, and she has spoken for the Maryland program because of the difference in how the public's investment is treated. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Yeah. Yes, President.
Thanks, Chair. And given the crowded calendar, I'll need to follow up with Representative Bailey with some of the same questions. Can you, again, sort of using your best five-year-old description, and by that I don't mean a description that's lasted for 5 years, but one that's helpful for a five-year-old
understanding. Yes.
of the kind of company, you know, the kind of scenario, like a quick story about, you know, what happens, how it's used, and why it's so great.
Which, with huge emphasis on quick. Because
right,
you,
right.
Thank you.
So the idea is, we say to insurance companies, and it's mostly insurance companies, if you put $100 in our state, we'll give you a tax credit for $10 or $30, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then you have it. And you have 5 years to invest it, the money. Meanwhile, you have the tax credit. And at the end of 5 years, you have to have, I don't remember, I think it's 85% of it invested in our state. So basically, we've given you $30, you have $100. 5 years later, 85% of that money needs to be invested in our state. And you need to leave it there as an investment for 5 to 7 years, and after that, it's all yours. You get all the benefit.
Thanks. Given the chair's preference, I got lots of questions. It sounds like you do too. This seems like the kind of thing it would be nice to really explore to understand it. I'll set that aside for now.
Thank you for the questions. Thank you very much. We appreciate the testimony. With that, I'm going to wait. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill? No. But I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3227 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3345. Representative Brewer, thank you for your patience.
Which bill is this?
3345.
Sorry, I had to gather up all my things. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House Bill 3345 is about the Betsy credit, but it doesn't talk about the merits of it, qualifying for it, or anything like that. This is, in my idea, something I threw out there to impact cash flow to the state, but keeping the Betsy credit, or however it may be changed, by other bills, and there's many other bills on Betsy. What this does, while there's two, in Section 1, talks about the 31A, talks about the 35, excuse me, 11A talks about the 35% credit, and then Section 1C talks about the 50% credit. The 50% credit, simply by mathematics, I'm not proposing any changes to it, but in form it shows that there would be some. But the 35% credit, I think we have some room for here to help out the state of Oregon on our cash flow. The 35% credit is once someone qualifies for a credit and is given a credit, is they can use the 35% over 5 years at a rate of 10%, 10%, 5, 5, and 5. And then they also can enter into carry forwards. What I'd like to do is throw out that we should scale back the front loading in the first 2 years of the Betsy credit because of the fiscal area, or the economy that we're in and the fiscal impact to our current budget, to decrease that front loading it from 10 and 10% in the first 2 years to some slower rate. I don't know what the answer is to that rate. I threw this in with blank percentages because, as you understand, most of the time Betsy credits are financed through a secondary finance market. I don't know what the number less than 10% is in the first 2 years, what the answer is, so that the secondary finance market actually works as a funding mechanism, but it is something that we can go down less than 10%. My goal is with this is to keep the Betsy credit in whatever form it changes to for targeted job growth and economic development vital to my constituency, to keep that in its place, but to also relieve the cash flow of the state of Oregon, recognizing the time that we're in at this moment.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative White.
Just real quick, just wondering, this here, I'm supportive of what you're doing here, but I got to thinking about it afterwards, and I'm wondering if we go and change that percentage, we'll take a little burden off of us right now, but are we going to end up with a bigger burden a couple years down the road? So when things start rotating around.
Mr. Chair and Representative Widener, I absolutely agree that there is a deferral of the credit at this point. The credit's not going away. It is a timing difference. But I hope that we are in a better position in 2 years than we are currently as a state. that hopefully if we have some taxpayers that currently generate some tax credits now, we will also increase our income tax base and be able to give some taxes back so that we can better afford a deferral in years 3 through 5.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you for your time.
I have no one else signed up to testify on this bill 3345. Is there anyone else that wanted to be heard? See no one. I'm going to close the public hearing on 3345 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2956. Zach, now that I'm looking for you to get a long ways off, what is this bill about?
House Bill 2956 appropriates money from the general fund to the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to be dispersed to the Independent Development Enterprise Alliance.
And we have a number of folks signed up. Roy J. Roy J. here?
Yep.
Right. Why don't you come up? And then I think the next group is a panel. But is Representative Frederick here?
He's out. He's next door or something.
He's next door. Okay. We'll go get it. Did Alexandria Reese and Robert King want to come up with Mr. J? And then when Representative Frederick gets here, we'll have him join you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for this time that we've got to brief time that we have to come and tell you our story. For those of you that are that may not be familiar with Project Clean Slate, it's a program that is operated through a nonprofit independent development enterprise. She's passing you out some information just so you can be on the same page with us. We have been funded through the state and other sources for the past several years. This is a community service program like none other. We actually help people get back to work. They're paying child support. We're removing traffic fines and making people better citizens along the way. So I brought colleagues and helpers and people that have been involved with this program for a number of years. One lady is a client who's just finishing off the program. The other one is he's not a client. He's actually been with us for as many years as I can remember. And so we just wanted to come in briefly to tell our story and hope that we can move this along. So without further ado, I want to spend my time introducing Lieutenant Robert King from the Portland Police Department. He can give you his 2 minutes. And I realize that we're on. Did you notice I said 2 minutes? real brief, real short. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Co-Chair Benz, okay. Co-Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Robert King. For the record, I'm a lieutenant with Portland Police Bureau. Just here to share briefly with you my experience with Project Clean Slate and ask for your support for this important legislation. I believe in this program. I believe that it represents, for many people, a second chance. I think, to a great extent, this second chance is, among other things, to get their driver's license back. I, for the last couple of years now, have taught a one-hour course, basically, that is your rights and the law. It essentially is the same training and information that we provide to recruit police officers, and it focuses around traffic stops and around person stops. But in addition to the law, there is a police officer that is in contact with a group of folks who many of times have had negative experiences with police. And so we begin the class by asking them, who in here has had a bad experience with a police officer? And in most classes, most all hands go up. And in fact, in some occasions, two hands go up for some people. So essentially, We begin the class focusing on the law, and we get the class to agree that we're going to talk about the material and not about all those negative emotional experiences that I know people have and I know are valid and legitimate for them. But I want you to know that one of the other things that happens there that's important is that I communicate to people that, first and probably foremost, I believe that when you treat people with respect, you get respect in return. That as officers, we are responsible for following the law, and as a citizen, when you're unhappy with our performance or your service, that you have recourse. Call the precinct. Talk to the sergeant. Call the commander of the precinct, make a complaint if appropriate, and that we take people's concerns about our service very seriously. I share my expectations, the expectations that I have for the officers who work for me, and I'm clear with them in the classroom setting that as officers, I expect my officers to perform their duties professionally and to follow the law and the policies of the police bureau, and most importantly, to treat all people with respect. I communicate this message to each class, and And I let people know that I hold officers to that standard. And the course is an hour long. In the course of this hour that we spend together talking about traffic stops and the law and person stops and the law, there is a shift that goes on in the class. I see it every month we do the class. And essentially, there is a change in perspective because of the discussion, because of the dialogue. Knowledge is power. You know, who among us doesn't like to be better informed? Everybody in the room feels valued and feels respected. And I communicate repeatedly that everybody deserves to be treated fairly and with respect. Now, I'll tell you, I began helping with this important program because my 6th and 7th grade teacher, Joe Nunn, who is a part of the program, asked me to help. As an African-American man, he powerfully shaped and influenced my life as I was growing up. I keep coming back because I want to have a positive impact on how people view the police, especially those people in the community that have had negative experiences with police officers. Just as Mr. Nunn did for me when I was 12 and 13, I want to do in the class basically what he did, and that is communicate to them that they can overcome their current circumstance, they can be better informed, that this program can help them get back on their feet. It can help them accomplish the goal of getting a driver's license back and feel good about that accomplishment. But most importantly in the class, they know that they're valued and that they're respected, and that if they have other experiences with the police, that they have a recourse for that. So in closing, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I ask that you support this important program.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Keep in mind that this program, as you can probably read from the materials, started in July of 2005 as a one-time only event to service 500 people. It was a private public partnership with our organization and Multnomah County Circuit Court and District Attorney. Here we are years later. We have a waiting list of over 18,000 waiting to get into a program that's become so successful because we do have people actually going back to work. They're paying child support, and we're trying to move them forward because there's too many barriers. One of the people that is currently in the program, and I asked her to come down so she can tell her story because she's had an up and down life, and I'm just, you know, I just met her again for the first time just this morning, so we drove down together, and her name is Alexandra Reese, and she's going to give her 2 minutes about what the program has done for her.
Hello. As he said, I'm a current participant. I'm just at the tail end.
Could you identify yourself so we have your name on the record?
My name is Alexandria Reese.
Thank you. And then if you stay about a foot away from the microphone, it works best.
Excuse me for 1 second. Can we have Representative Fredericks?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Introduce.
Sorry, Representative.
Because he's
sorry.
He's running between. He's
yes,
trying to
please.
Clone himself at this point.
Please.
No one wants me to be cloned. Believe me.
Sorry, Representative. Please go ahead.
I apologize, and may I interrupt just a bit here? Co-Chair Benson, the committee, thank you for letting me speak, especially ahead of time here. I'm Lou Frederick, representative from House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I introduced House Bill 2956 because I was there when Project Clean Slate held its first event in July 2005, and I've had the privilege of watching it develop into a program that's helped thousands in the Portland area. This bill is written to provide a bit of support and to keep it going and expand it to other areas of the state as invited by local jurisdictions. Project Clean Slate's original idea was to bring together judges, district attorneys, the DMV, and prior offenders who were ready to turn their lives around to see what could be done to remove some barriers to making that happen. It was such a good idea that the crowd showed up for the first day-long event was about 10 times what was expected. I think they estimated 300 folks would show up. They had about 3,000 ringing the block. It was really quite something. I spent a good deal of the afternoon helping people sign up for a waiting list. First of all, this isn't an amnesty program. These people have to follow through on fulfilling the commitments the court requires of them. But it does help get those commitments to something they can fulfill. And it helps them navigate the sometimes mystifying world of court forms and procedures. It has also assisted individuals who were hiding from the law to face the music, turn themselves in, and begin the process of paying their debt in order to reenter society. This program has really, truly proven itself in the last 5 years, 5.5 years. It saves money, it clears court backlogs, and it saves lives. And the benefits reach into the community as whole families benefit when a family member is able to work through these issues, become employable, and go through the day without looking over his or her shoulder. those who are more intimately involved with this program, you're going to hear, you've heard from, I've got to tell you, I am just really pleased that I was allowed to be a volunteer back in 2005, because it really was quite an experience for me to see people who I knew for years, who had been struggling and had been looking over their shoulders for years, able to re-enter the full society. I was very, very pleased, and I encourage you to support this particular program. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative, and I apologize again for not getting up here a little sooner.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Questions for the Representative?
Well, I just have a real quick question, and I was the department of the administrative department, I guess, is my question. Is that how it's done now, or it seemed odd to me that that would be the vehicle or the agency?
This was the suggestion in terms of how it might be put together to spread it out to the rest of the state. That's the concern. And I should also tell you that there is a Dash 1 amendment that brings the amount requested to 300,000 from the 700,000 I think you have in the bill itself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this to us, Representative Frederick, because I know this is a great program. I'm just wondering, when you had the conversations, did they talk about having it in judiciary at all or trying to find a home for it there, if those discussions came up and how they transpired? Because it would make more sense for a program like this to be functioning there where you're dealing with the same issues.
Co-Chair Bence and Representative Widener, I understand that it was not the decision was made to place it in this particular committee. I really could not tell you how that reasoning took place, but I know that folks here do understand this particular program as well. So it's very likely that that was part of the reasoning behind it.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, it's an awesome program. I love this review, and I talked about this at length here a few months ago. My question is about the money, and it seems like you guys have been running really well as a nonprofit for a while, helping lots of people. Why not continue it as a nonprofit? Why come in and ask for $300,000 or $750,000, depending on which amendment?
Co-Chair Bence, Representative Sheehan, I will tell you that my understanding, first of all, this is not the total amount of money that this would be used for this particular program. They are involved with a number of other groups as well, and I'm going to turn that over to the guy who actually handles the program and understands all of the finances of this. I also wanted to make it a point that I got a chance to talk with the DAs from 9 different counties about this particular program. And there was an enthusiastic support that I got from Marion, from Yamhill County, from Clackamas County as well. And there's also a letter from the district attorney from Multnomah County as well for you in terms of support. They understand how that might work. In terms of the finances, I'm going to turn that over to you.
I'll be glad to make it as brief as possible. For 4 years, or almost three years, from 2005 to 2008, this program, we had not planned to continue it. But because of the growing number of people that were there the first time, I had to make some personal decisions as to I'm involved in other business ventures, so that it gave me some time for me to be able to do some things. So for three years, the entire program was funded from my retirement, my 401k, loss of a wife, and everything else in order to keep this program going because I saw so many people's lives change. We finally wound up in front of Representative Chip Chiles at some point in time asking the state to also help step in to see if they could try and do something. That's how we've been able to keep at least some minimum things going. We've got some small grants and things of that nature, but you know, this is for the most part, it's a significant part of the operating because most of the stuff is only for administrative and staff salaries and things of that nature. You know, Lieutenant King, for instance, comes on his own time. We've got bankers. We've got people from private enterprise. It's the synergy of public-private because we want to see people do better. But trust me, nobody has ever got rich on this, and my retirement is down to zero. I mean, I may want to go in the legislature or something. Did I say that? Okay. But it's, you know, it's just one of those things that you knew that you had to do rather than just disappoint a lot of people, and that's what we've been doing. We have been basically operating on fumes, and we continue to do it. But it's, you know, you'll hear from her and you'll hear from other folks that have that are in very, in support of this.
Again, I'm going to apologize. I need to get next door. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative.
And I hope you, if you have other questions, please feel free to contact me, and I'm sure that a number of folks will be available. And you have Representative Wong, who's
Representative,
here as well.
Yeah, and I know that he's on a tight time frame, too. So.
No, I'm not. It's
like oh, that. Okay. Okay, you want to go?
Ms. Reese.
Hi, my name is Alexandria Reese. I am a current participant just at the tail end of finishing up this program. I know a lot of people who have been through it already and just the amazing things that it has helped them do in their lives. It's extremely encouraging. In the, I believe, like 2 years that I was on the waiting list to get into it, I kind of fumbled my way through trying to get my life together, and it was extremely overwhelming. And I know that for a lot of people, that extreme pressure, it's too much, and they end up going back out or throwing in the towel. And with the help of this program, it is that much easier to re-enter society, to become a productive member. And I especially like the way the community service is. It's more fulfilling than just paying off fines, because I did a fair share of that before I actually got accepted into the program. But with the community service, it's more of a way of giving back to the community that I know I took so much from while in the mistakes of my past. I really feel like if this program, especially, was more widespread, it would have a lot more impact as well. I know a lot of people that even have never heard of it, and I start telling them a little bit more about the program, and they're like, that's really cool, or they tell me they've seen something about it on the news or something like that. And I could have taken care of the things that this program has helped me, but it was a lot harder to find the path. Even conversating with people that I entered into the program with, they're like, I don't understand. You know, that what they gave us a list of things we have to do, and we got to do all this running around and get these things checked off, and we're paying to do this. And I had to explain to this woman that without this program, without this list of things, would you even know the first right step to take to try to get your life back in order? To try to get all of this debt and fines and whatnot under control, would you even know if it were not for this program?
Thank you very much. That's extremely helpful testimony, so we very much appreciate taking time to come down and talk to us. Are there questions for that witness? Yes, Representative Smith.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe something that Representative Wong can also respond to. First of all, thanks. Right. I mean, it's and thanks to you, Roy. It's been really valuable to have it. I guess my hope/concern/maybe question related to Representative Sheehan's is I don't have objection with this getting government funds. I would hope it'd be the kind of thing that leveraged additional, private dollars rather than merely, sort of replaced it, kept it to the same scale, and didn't do any obvious additional, goodness. So I don't know what plans there might be for that, but any commentary on that would be great.
I'll be glad to quickly answer. We're always out trying to find some private funds, and we have had some little dribbles and drabbles. Some of the stuff that we get now is maybe from organizations where in the construction industry, for instance. A lot of these companies now realize that their own employees can't drive the company truck or the van because they have no driver's license, and so they have to wind up going through Project Clean Slate in order for them to maintain their professional standards of being able to be a carpenter or sheetrocker or something of that nature. So we do have some private companies that give us what I call dribbles and drabbles of money, because it's there to help some of the rest of their employees. And then we have a little bit of money that comes from Portland Development Commission, which expires on June 30th. And the city's had budget cuts as well, so we've got to do as much as we can with what little that we've got. But we can't ignore the fact that we do have 18,000 people waiting, and I think she's a good testament. She waited for two years just to get her letter to show up in court, and this is the young lady that went from as public information, so it went from drugs to everything else you can imagine to now she's a stellar student at Portland Community College, and she's got her life on track. And this is just one of many, many, many people that this program reaches out to touch all over every zip code you could imagine, from people all have issues in Multnomah County, and they can't move forward. I don't need to tell you guys that, because if you've got any type of professional license, you have to make sure that you're paying your bills and paying your support and everything else. So with that, I'm going to yield to our representative.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. Matthew Wand, state representative from Troutdale. I first heard about Project Clean Slate about a year ago, and so I am not deeply involved in the program, but my support of the program is both philosophical and policy-oriented. On a philosophical level, the concern that a lot of folks have with these types of programs, especially from the government, is whether they're doing any good, whether we're really accomplishing anything, whether people move through the program and treat it as a hand up. What has encouraged me about Project Clean Slate is clearly it is a hand up. It is an opportunity for people who want to turn their lives around and be productive members of society operating within the law to do so. And the people tend to be very motivated. So on a philosophical level, it feels pretty good to know that you are helping putting people back to work who may not otherwise be able to get to work or be able to work paying taxes and supporting their own families. And secondly, from a policy level, I'm always interested in situations where our dollars go further and where we accomplish something that benefits us down the road. And when you take a person who is operating because of certainly mistakes in their past, which tend to happen a lot more when you're from a depressed area than from a more affluent area, and when you take that person and they see no opportunity to get back within the law, they tend to stay there, and they tend to not pay taxes. If you bring them into an area where they're able to work, then they tend to pay taxes. And so it is a dollar spent that comes back in a positive way and helps us build a stronger community in the meantime.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. Questions? Yes, Representative Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This will probably be for you, Royce. Last weekend, and I've had a meeting with some of the rehab centers in my community. One of the things we're trying to do is get away from the government funds, and most of these are operating without them. And the way they're functioning is the court, they're working with the local court system. It's in Yamhill County.
Okay.
And the judge will send them to one of these rehab centers, say Serenity House. Is what they'll do is bring them in. First thing's getting them clean, finding what kind of assistance they can get them, and then once they got them doing things around the house, they get them a job, and they start paying into the house. So every member of the house pays into it. I'm just wondering, something to think about for this is, as you're bringing through people through Clean Slate, when we get them back to the working stage, is there a portion that could be going back to help funding and keeping Clean Slate going? Because once they've bought into it, you know, they're more than willing to give 5-10%.
Yeah, Representative Widener, keep in mind that not a large number of people that are in Project Clean Slate are going through rehab. I mean, there's, you know, we've got local programs, but most of these people are in plain sight. I mean, they're working in office buildings, they're downtown, they're, you know, they're working at Walgreens or wherever that they're working, but they can't move forward because they owe the court thousands of dollars worth of traffic fines. They've got child support. They're trying to avoid garnishments and things of that nature. Some of them have went through rehab, and this is a good one here. I mean, we're proud of her thing, but that only represents maybe about 8 or 10%. And I agree that they need to pay back something, but this was, you know, the reason that this has been so successful. And if you look at these numbers, the public-private partnership here, the way that we run it, we figured out it costs about $337 per candidate versus if Multnomah County did it, if you talk with people there, they say it would cost them over $603 per client to do something similar to what we're doing. Our whole objective is to remove some of these barriers, get them back on track. They're already working. Some of them are working. And to pay child support, and we're going to forget the fines. The fines are going to be worked out through meaningful community service. Now, that can mean any number of things, not just picking up bushes and berries and things of that nature, but sometimes you got to go through rehab. You know, the judge will issue them certain orders in order for them to meet those requirements. But a lot of it has got to do with parenting skills, personal community responsibility. That's where Lieutenant King comes in, because a lot of folks have never had that type of interaction with real employers that we have come in, and bankers that are helping people repair their credit, without charging them any money, because you can't move forward. You just really can't move forward. So, you know, it's not one size fits all, but each of these, there's only four or five counselors that are in this program, and each of us are carrying a load of about 800 to 900 people at a time, all for $337 per client. And, I mean, it's not that we're juggling them all at one time, but there's a waiting list.
Thank you, Mr. Jay.
Just very, very to finish, I don't need anything. It's just to throw out an idea,
right,
to start thinking of something creative so you're not relying on us.
I understand.
Budgetary cuts,
yep,
and things like that.
I understand.
And that's the thing we're dealing with here.
Yep.
So
I definitely understand.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you. Further questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for coming down. We appreciate it. And I have no one else signed up for the HB 2956. Is there anyone else that wanted to be heard? That I'm going to.
Mr. Chair, before you
yes,
close it, and they don't need to respond to it, but Roy, it would be helpful if there were data on cost effectiveness of the program for criminal results. That would be helpful to get offline. I think it'll also help make the case in Ways and Means, like, hey, we get, you know, for this expenditure that saves us these amount of dollars, or that yields whatever, as we can start moving that direction in our public safety. I also want to say it to Representative Wand, so when we're in judiciary, I mean, this would be the kind of question I'd be asking if we were in Judiciary Committee, like, what's cost effectiveness of this versus prison versus, you know, drug treatment versus, you know, whatever else we can make sensible evaluations. That'd be helpful.
Right. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
You. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one additional suggestion that you might include when you're responding with information. It was mentioned in testimony earlier that it helps clear court backlogs. If you could help us understand the fiscal impact of that, you know, what it means to clear a backlog, is it just that something is easier, or it actually results in some cost savings as well?
Okay.
Thank you.
Do we have people signed up for this?
Yes.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2956. I'm going to open a public hearing on 3113. And we're going to move fairly rapidly through this bill. So can you tell us about it, Zach?
House Bill 3113 exempts from property taxation items of tangible personal property used exclusively on an owner's farm parcel, primarily to promote the sale of products produced on the parcel or on other local farm parcels.
We have Dave Honeycutt, Mike Kropp, and Gil Rydell. If the three of you could come up. And gentlemen, I hate to put pressure on you, but I'm going to.
Very.
About a minute and a half to 2 minutes each, please.
Certainly.
Thank you, Mr. That's all right. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Members of Committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. House Bill 3113 is a bill that we think clarifies existing law. We don't believe that the bill extends current law. It clarifies a 1999 amendment brought and passed through that legislature that deals with personal property tax exemptions, a language that was introduced and passed in that committee to provide some relief for farmers and ranchers from personal property taxes for farm equipment used in the production, used in agricultural production. What the 99 legislature didn't anticipate that has now come to pass is the rise of farmers marketing their products directly to the consumer through things like pumpkin patches and the like. That this issue arose out of a dispute with Mr. Kropp, who's sitting to my left, and Washington County. And the intent of this legislation is to essentially resolve that dispute and do what we believe the 99 legislature has already done, or at least intended to do. So with that, we're very supportive of the bill, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Kropp is here to answer questions. The bill was brought on his behalf by Representative Lindsay and Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Dave. Who would like to go next?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representatives, my name is Mike Kropp. I'm a farmer 18 miles west of Portland, close to the metro area of Washington County. I started farming in 1964, raising grain, clovers, and eventually grass seed on 1,600 acres. In 1988, we expanded our operation to include fresh produce, U-pick strawberries, on 10 of those acres. 20 years later, we progressed to 12 acres of pumpkins, a corn maze of 18 acres, and each year, thousands of customers come through our farm to get their pumpkins, corn, and straw bales. Last year, a personal property auditor called us into a meeting and informed us that when a customer picks a pumpkin from the vine, it is no longer a farm crop, but a product, and therefore we no longer qualify as a farm. Accordingly, we are now subject to personal property taxes on all the equipment at the pumpkin patch. This includes computers, wheelbarrows, any pumpkin patch decor, our trains, boats that take people to and from the pumpkin patch. Even the farm equipment that I've saved from my grandfather's days on the farm will now be taxed because I park them where the public can see them. On top of that, we would have to pay 5 years back taxes and a 50% penalty. The 1999 legislature expressly recognized the need to provide farmers with some relief from personal property taxes on farm-related equipment. However, current law is unclear regarding whether the relief of the 1999 legislature provided, does it extend to farm equipment used on the farm to market products directly to the public through pumpkin patches, corn mazes, or any other similar effort. Coupled with county efforts to find new revenue, the relief which we have fought so hard for in 1999 may have not kept up with the times today. Rather than having a court answer that question, we believe it is better for the legislature to resolve the issue through House Bill 3113 and not act to stifle our industry's efforts and better promote and market our products to the general public. Thank you for your time and support of Oregon agriculture.
Thank you very much. Mr. Riddell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. ALC opposes this bill for the several reasons that I've listed on the double-sided sheet that you're about to receive, and I'm going to step through this quickly. I'm going to start actually at the bottom. You've heard that this is subject of litigation in Washington County. It's dangerous to set broadly applicable public policy based on a single fact-based dispute. We don't know what the revenue impact is on this. We don't know what the definitions mean precisely, and it has implications for land use policy. So for all those reasons, we would be against it. In addition, on the matter of new property tax exemptions, you should ask at least three questions. Is it necessary to implement an important statewide public purpose? Is it the only way to accomplish that purpose? And will the economic sector fail without the property tax exemption? The property tax system is already cut, capped, and limited to the benefit of the property tax owner. In fact, Measure 5, the tax rate limits in Measure 5 were applied by statute, not by the ballot measure, to farm use special assessment, an additional benefit to the farm taxpayer. Under Oregon's rate-based property tax system, a new exemption causes a straight loss of revenue for education and public services. 44% of the property taxes go to schools. The state backfills shortfalls in schools, as you know. The county share of property taxes helps us fund state shared services to the same constituents as the state. The Task Force on Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring recommended that the legislature refrain from new property tax expenditures and that they do no harm that will make local government's fiscal situation worse. For those reasons, we oppose this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Riddell. Are there questions for this panel? Yes, Mr. Weiner, Representative Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question would be, and Dave, you may want to take this, but when they were trying to do this, are they trying to zone the property commercial or residential? Are they going to change the zoning on it, or are they going to leave it farm and then tax him as if he was a commercial property?
Co-chair, Mr. Co-chair, Representative Widener, this bill and this dispute has nothing to do with land use policy. This bill wouldn't change land use policy in the slightest, nor does the current dispute have to do with land use policy. The dispute and what this bill seeks to clarify is an argument over whether or not a farmer who's engaged in a direct marketing to the public through, in this case, a pumpkin patch, whether the equipment that the farmer uses as part of the pumpkin patch operation is subject to exemption from personal property taxes under the current statute. We believe that it is, and obviously Washington County takes a different position. Because of the ambiguity in the legislation, we feel that it's better to resolve that issue here. But the activities won't change, nor would there be any change in the zoning of the property resulting from either from this dispute or from this bill. And everybody recognizes that the use of the property is a farm use, which is certainly authorized in an exclusive farm use, and that's what you're supposed to do there.
Thank you. Further questions of this panel? See none. Thank you very much. Thank you for bringing this most interesting issue forward. It has a strange familiarity given the discussions we're having on wineries and other similar activities on farm ground. Yes, Sina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bentz, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association represents approximately 900 special service districts throughout the state, and I'm here in opposition to House Bill 3113. Some of our special districts are highly dependent on property taxes. Districts like rural fire protection districts, parks and recreation districts, and library districts. Some of those entities actually rely almost solely on property tax revenue. And unlike a city or a county, a special district, because we are single service and purpose in nature, we don't have the opportunity to decide if a property tax exemption is granted by the legislature, where are we going to shift those dollars? What are we going to do? Are we going to cut the library department or the parks department or the planning department? We provide one service, so we take the cut as it is, and we move forward. So we oppose the legislation. Speaking of being vaguely familiar, this bill actually was brought forward in the 2009 legislative session. It was not advanced. It's our recommendation that the legislature allow the legal process to continue to take its course, since this issue is currently in litigation. And the county, as I understand it, is entered into some mediation with Mr. Krupp. Furthermore, to the issue of using this piece of this equipment to promote the sale, I believe the language on line 30 and the next page, promote the sale of products for farm use. It's my understanding that Mr. Krupp operates, or the piece of property operates, a train that transports people through this pumpkin patch and possibly a boat. So I'm not necessarily sure that the policy of using this for agricultural, promoting the sale of agricultural products, whether it's a pumpkin patch and a choo-choo train, is necessarily something that the legislature should actually grant a property tax exemption for. That, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Squires? Yes, Representative Widener.
Hasina, just real quickly. When this train, I don't think, is a large locomotive. I think it's probably just a small train for entertainment for the guests when they come out, just like if they hooked up behind a tractor and had hay bales. If he's growing pumpkins and it's farm activity going on, if we don't clarify this language with something, how are we ever going to see remediation? Because then we're leaving it in the hands of the judge, because they don't have any clarity on what they're going to come up with the solution. And there's a lot of small farmers and large farmers that are doing this as a public service or a public good that are going to get in this situation with their counties, or because one person comes out and is upset. So how can we bring clarity to this situation if we don't move this bill?
Co-Chair Bentz, Representative Widener, members of the committee, that is, I guess, the crux of the bill, that it was a policy decision on behalf of this legislature to clarify one way or the other what really constitutes a proper property tax exemption, and our argument would be that this does not.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wishes to be heard on HB 3113? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on 3113. I'm going to open a public hearing on 3438. Zach, tell us about Bill.
House Bill 3438 limits the authority for the Metropolitan Service District to establish an urban growth boundary.
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I really like Matt Wan's new haircut. And I am also Patrick Sheehan. And I am the state representative from House District 51. We have our Metro bill here today. This is 3438. This is mostly a housekeeping issue, kind of fixes some technical glitches. Actually, this is a really big bill. It comes down to a single sentence there in Section 1 that reads, "The Legislative Assembly finds and declares that making the land use planning process simpler and more efficient is an issue of statewide concern." We think that it's time to begin the conversation as to whether Metro's reach into rural communities is providing the kind of value for its citizens that was in mind when they were chartered. Now, in 1979, Metro chartered to provide vision to plan for growth in three counties that touch the urban core of Portland. At the time, counties and cities didn't have access to the graphical information systems they have today. Land use planning at these levels was broad and less defined. Cities and counties were smaller, and transportation infrastructure was far less developed than it is today. Metro provided the connective tissue for transportation and land planning between the three counties, eventually expanding to manage into waste and recycling, the convention center, the zoo, and some parks. The bill is about starting the conversation as to whether Metro has accomplished the goal of providing this connective tissue and planning inside the urban core, and should now hand planning back to the cities and counties in the rural reaches. What I see today is that Metro is burdening communities like Damascus and Forest Grove with an unwanted vision that binds these communities to a livability target dictated by the planners who established their rules based on a model of downtown Portland. So at what point do we have this conversation? Do we have that now, or do we wait for Metro to reach Hogsback, Oregon City, Canby, or Malala? They're currently planning some of the rural areas of Oregon City, Sherwood, and Hillsboro. Now, in 1979, this was the first instance of regional government in the country and was billed as a model. And it's a model that's never been duplicated anywhere. In more than 30 years, no other state has wanted to follow in our footsteps. So who thinks that having Metro managing land use planning is still a good idea? Now, you'll hear from lots of government agencies and commercial real estate dealers who depend on the influence of Metro to bring projects to their areas. And some would argue that you'll hear from those same agencies who are afraid of upsetting Metro, who has the ability to make their lives difficult. The opposition to this bill has surprised both of us, and it's reached from local governments all the way to seemingly irrelevant lobbyists who were asked to take a position on the issue. They were organized by Metro's three full-time lobbyists. I even got a call from a freelance news writer who we looked up, and he is a news writer for Metro. I don't know why Metro needs to have their own news agency. Metro was supposed to be a replacement for city and county planning services, but it's now just another step. It's time to start the conversation about whether the reach of Metro into rural areas reflects the will of the people. Testimony from the bill's opponents will recognize that their land use planning process is lengthy and complex. We want land use planning to be easier, simpler, and more understandable for counties to implement based on what their communities want. Instead, we have stream setbacks in Damascus that make building of new North Clackamas schools almost impossible and encourage the building of underutilized consideration for pedestrian and bicycle traffic. The communities that Metro is now overseeing do not have cultural congruency with the livability targets that make sense for downtown Portland. So here we are, starting the conversation, and that's what we're here to do today.
Thank you, Representative. Judging from the people that signed up, you have started the conversation. Representative Wan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Matthew Wan, State Representative from Troutdale. I appreciate Representative Sheehan allowing me to be a part of this bill and this conversation with him. It touches Damascus in a little more intimate way than it does in Troutdale because they are so undeveloped and so rural at this point. But I can tell you in my experience as a city councilor in Troutdale that our concerns are no less valid than what Damascus has unfortunately experienced over the last 5 years. One of the first issues that I dealt with as a city councilor in Troutdale revolved around a particular policy goal called Title 13. That's the number. The name is Nature in Neighborhoods. And I'm going to tell you about this not to get too much into the weeds of a particular policy issue, but to use it rather as an analogy and an illustration of the way that this process works and why it is not reflective of the individual citizens that are required to live under it. Under Title 13, which is an outcropping of Goal 5, the Metro created a model ordinance, and they asked every city to adopt it. And as a brand new, wet behind the ear city councilor, my first question to our staffers and planners was, what are you trying to accomplish with nature and neighborhoods? And they said, well, we want to have animals and we want to have plants. And I said, great. In my neighborhood, we have raccoons. We had a cougar sighting at the local park. Troutdale has been Tree City USA for a decade. And we have wide areas of parks, more than most cities around the entire metro area. So my conclusion quite simply was, wonderful, I'm in favor of nature. Seems like our land use development ordinance already accomplishes that. Good enough for me. The response that we received back proved, in my estimation, why I do not consider the way that this works to be coordination, but rather top-down. We received notice that there would be reductions in funding for certain green spaces. We received word that we would be losing funding for certain positions. Quite simply, it became very clear to me that rather than a coordination effort and an opportunity for us to work together, it was an instance of we had better adopt it or else. So I inquired further. How did the city of Troutdale have impact into the development of Title 13? How did our citizens get to have a voice in how and whether this particular policy would be drafted? That was when I learned about the alphabet soup, as I like to call it, MPAC and JPAC. Now, as a citizen, I had never heard of either of those two entities. I don't believe most of my neighbors had either. MPAC is the Metro Policy Advisory Committee, which has 21 votes that are primarily determined based upon the population of the areas. Gresham has a vote. The cities of Multnomah County have a vote. Portland has a vote, and Multnomah County has a vote. 4 votes out of 21. Troutdale, of course, only contributing to one of those. And I was told that our opportunity for input went through MPAC. But, of course, with only 2 or 3 or 4 votes out of 21, it's very difficult to have much of a voice. Those policy advisory committees and Metro as a whole is insulated from our citizens. They institute a top-down, one-size-fits-all approach that certainly doesn't reflect the values of my community. There are several disadvantages with this level of coordination, and I'm almost concluded, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you for your patience.
You.
One of the main disadvantages is that it locks in gains in the areas that were developed first. Because these committees are developed on the basis of population, if you are residing in an area that's already fully developed, you get to decide how areas outside of your community that aren't fully developed are to develop, which means that those of us that live there have less of a voice in how our own community is going to look when the property is developed. And it's important for me to say to all of you that those of us that live in these communities, we do not look at them as a playground. They are our homes. They are our communities. We are interested in living and building our lives there based upon the values that we share with our neighbors, not based upon the values of people who don't live there and want to use it as a place for them to go and enjoy themselves. Secondly, there is a lock-in and a problem with the way that the urban growth boundary is discussed. I can't tell you how many times in this building I have heard the words, there is insufficient industrial land available for development in the Portland metro area. Hogwash. It may not be in the areas that Metro recognizes on the west side, but where I come from, there are huge tracts of land that are waiting for development, both in the Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park, in the Springwater area, and in and around Damascus. The land is there in the current system, but the people who are in charge do not prefer for that development or for those jobs to come to our neighborhoods. They prefer for those jobs to go someplace else. And if we're serious about building a better community, this is the solution that helps us. Allowing Troutdale and Gresham and Damascus and Wood Village and Fairview the opportunity to make their own land use decisions in consultation with their citizens is the way for us to create jobs, because we know how we want to live and we know how to build jobs in our own communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We do have a few folks signed up. So the first panel will be, I'm pretty sure this is Ralph Groner, Mayor Spinnett, and Dave Honeycutt. And gentlemen, if you could all come forward. Let's see, do we have all three here? Looks like we're short. No, there's two. It's Dave outside. There he is. Go ahead, Ralph, you first. And again, we're going to have to end this hearing at about 12 minutes till for procedural issues. So please,
Mr. Chair, thank you. I will rush as fast as I can. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner. I speak loud because I am hard of hearing, and the other day I'm in a hearing, I couldn't hear one word the representative said. So I speak a little louder for those of us my age that are growing hearing impaired. Ralph Groner, I work for AFSCME. I've submitted a letter from Ken Allen in opposition to this particular bill. He's our executive director, and I've given you some talking points, but I'll do mine rapidly. My history has been in economic development. I carried Senate Bill 100 at the request of Governor Tom McCall and Senator at that time on the floor of the House. The most controversial bill in 1973 was Senate Bill 100, and I only want to comment that citizen participation actually was our number one goal, and I just heard that that's not happening, yet at the same time we have a newsletter. And the newsletter is to help encourage and citizen participation. Secondly, I left Senate Bill 100 to go run for county commissioner because of two babies, and maybe we could afford to buy them some food, and ran for county commissioner, and mistakenly I won for 8 years and ended up having to zone an unzoned county. So I apologize if we zoned Damascus wrong. We zoned it rural. Primarily, I remember we had to go to LUBA. That's the Land Use Board of Appeals. We had to have deputies with us wherever we went in the county because it was unzoned, and it's not really always as social as Multnomah County when you hit my rural areas. I hope you understand where we had to zone it one way or another. Then I left that. I was a county commissioner. They asked me to serve on CRAG. I'm doing this history because it's important to Metro. CRAG was the Columbia Region Association of Government. Some may not be aware, in the audience at least, that if you're going to receive federal transportation dollars, you must have a regional body to coordinate. That's JPAC. We call that JPAC. You all have to have a JPAC in your region to receive federal transportation dollars. Let me give you an example of how regional cooperation worked. At that time, Mayor Neil Goldschmidt opposed something I supported. It was called, and I ended up right, the Mount Hood Corridor. Now we're building the Sunrise Corridor, and years later it's costing us hundreds of millions more to connect one freeway to the other so that we can create jobs, which actually, not just because I'm a union person, we have to have income tax coming into this building to pay primarily 70% of K-12, my senior programs, our corrections, that's my union, our parole and probation officers, our judges, our DAs and assistants at the local level. I then said I've got to do something in Clackamas County, and some may not be aware of this, but I was the first chair of the Urban Renewal Board, what's called the Town Center, and I'll do this quickly. That Town Center, these years later, by the way, then was a dump. Shacks surrounded it. Water came in on the land, nothing but a couple cows grazing. And quite frankly, if you'll look at it now, you'll see over $1 billion in the total area and property on the rolls. You'll also see hospitals, community colleges, four overpasses, urban renewal built,
and
by the way, $100 million.
If you could wrap it up.
Okay.
Thank you.
My point is the regional level is where I had to go to get the Oregon City bypass, which for 30 years was on hold, and we outgunned Goldschmidt because your cities I just heard about all collectively worked together so that we could get 213. My whole point is I want you to close with a thought. There was a transportation study I made the mistake of reading put out by Oregon Business Council, ODOT, Metro, and I believe the Port of Portland and City of Portland that showed that Oregon transportation for $1.5 million, which, by the way, seems to me the venue that ought to be voting on this issue, which they already have, should be voted on by over half of the state's population that would have said overwhelmingly we support this agency. Economic development is the key, bottom line. I'll end.
Thank you.
If we don't plan accordingly and correctly for the whole region, including, I'm sorry, I'm being respectful, Damascus, we already have one of the worst transportation crises in Portland Metro of any city, including Seattle. That means companies like Intel, farming, and so forth aren't going to be able to get their products to the market, and that hurts economic
development. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mayor Spinnet.
Thank you, co-chair, and members of the panel, representatives. If there's any, as you could probably tell by now, if there's any municipality in the whole state that's at ground zero, if you will, or in the throes of land use compliance, it's the city of Damascus. We were brought into the UGB in 2002 and incorporated as a city in 2004. We have just recently adopted our 370-page Envision Damascus Comprehensive Plan and have just submitted it to the DLCD. This has been really close to 9 years in progress, actually even longer than that. I have said all that to say this. The city of Damascus has federal, state, regional, county, and city land use requirements. Our little town of about 10,000 people have spent over nearly $3.5 million in planning with a lot, long ways to go. Last fall, I campaigned two major taglines in my campaign, local voice, local control. The second one was, this is our town, not Metro's. The community agreed. There is something else, too. There's in Metro's Title 11, there is an interim protection of areas added to the urban growth. That's what it says. Basically, it holds property, it land, in hostage until the moment it comes into the urban growth boundary, and until there's a completed comprehensive plan. We are now at 9 years and counting that people's property are held in hostage. I had a phone call from a gentleman, 30 acres. He can't do anything with it. He either has to sell it all or keep it all. At least we can allow that to be under county regulations and not Metro's. This five-layer of government planning requirement is burdensome, it's expensive, and most of all, it's unnecessary. Of course, governance and regulation are necessary, but Metro's planning authority brings our communities and economies past any reasonable and sustainable tipping point. It's gone way too far. Thank you.
Thank you. Ronica.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, and speaking in support of House Bill 3438, we certainly want, I think, the same things that Mr. Groner wants and his clients. This is just debate on the best way to get there. I think it's important to point out to the committee that we're not debating urban growth boundaries or the necessity of those. This bill doesn't take away the requirements that a city have an urban growth boundary. If the bill passed, it would be up to the individual cities to establish urban growth boundaries, something that if we were in 49 other states would be exactly what was occurring. The only reason we're having this debate here is that in Oregon they've decided, in the Portland metropolitan area, they've decided to do things differently than they have in the other 49 states. that doesn't mean that this is the that this bill is the only way to achieve achieve the goal. There are other ways to allow cities within the Portland metro region to exercise some self-control. In fact, you could probably draft legislation that created some kind of process for cities that are particularly aggrieved by the actions of Metro to exempt themselves or in some way ameliorate the problems that they're having. So there are other ways to do this. We like the way that it's done in this bill, but it certainly would be happy to work on other ways as well. And I would point out that there is precedent in this building in recent sessions for this something similar to what's being discussed here. A couple of sessions ago, Eugene and Springfield got a divorce for land use planning purposes because Springfield wanted to go one direction and Eugene wanted to go the other direction. It sounds to me like that's exactly what Damascus and Metro are. The city and Metro are at loggerheads. You've divorced cities for planning purposes. You could certainly do that in this situation as well. So we're supportive of the bill and hope that the legislature takes this issue up.
Thank you very much. And in the interest of time, colleagues, I hope there are no questions because I'd sure like to go to some more witnesses. Seeing none, thank you very much, gentlemen. Roger Miracle, Tom Hughes, Randy Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. Again, my name is Roger Miracle. I wish I had some impressive credentials to give to you today, but basically I'm just a citizen. I've been a resident of the Gresham-Damascus area for approximately 50 years. I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 3438. I have had the opportunity to watch the intrusion of Metro into our local communities. When I first moved back from the service to Gresham, we had a community of 12,000 people. We literally had the farmers drive up to the local Rexall drugstore, to the coffee shop, and just visit with the other farmers when I first moved there. Now we have a community that has seen the effects of the centralized planning through Metro that has, in a lot of opinions, ruined our community. Metro has a very distinct vision, and as Representative Sheehan explained, it's a vision for how a core city should operate. Unfortunately, they've expanded that vision to the outlying communities, and it has significantly changed our communities from rural communities to more reflect the core cities. There's a reason why people moved out of the core city, because they wanted a different lifestyle. We should have the options of selecting that lifestyle, and we should have the options of having local control so that we can decide for ourselves. In a way, it comes across to me personally that there's no respect for the intelligence of the local communities when I see what Metro dictates to us.
If you could wrap up, please.
I'm sorry?
If you could wrap up, please.
All right.
2 minutes are exhausted.
I'm against the Metro control. I'm very in favor of local control, and I like the effects of this House bill. Thank you very
much. Thank you. Please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Hughes. I am the president of the Metro Council. And with me today is our three lobbyists, Randy Tucker. And Randy is here to take the tough questions in case that you have any. I would like to just to mention the committee, those of you who are not familiar with my background, that prior to being elected Metro president last November, I had spent 8 years as mayor of the city of Hillsboro. And prior to that, I spent 15 years on the Hillsboro Planning Commission. And so most of what has happened in Hillsboro in the last 23 years has happened while I've been there to watch it, and I've been able to observe the interrelation between local government, in this case the city of Hillsborough, and Metro, and quite frankly it has not always been an easy relationship. We have taken issue with Metro. We've fought Metro over what we thought were mistakes that they were making in expansion of the urban growth boundary. I think we would have included at the time the inclusion of Damascus. But the reality was that Damascus was driven not by Metro policy, but by state law. That was where the exceptions lands were, and that was what the state required for urban growth boundary expansion. So the amount of land that we were able to expand on the west side in areas where we felt were more productive were somewhat limited. We managed to get 200 acres in 02, and on that we located Genentech, which was a pretty good acquisition. But I want to tell you that never in all the time that I was mayor, or never in any of the time that I was involved in planning in Hillsborough, even when we had disagreements with Metro, did we ever consider taking away Metro's authority to establish the urban growth boundary. We believe in the urban growth boundary. We believe the urban growth boundary is an important element of how we create the vibrancy that we have created in the Portland metropolitan area. We believe that vibrancy is an essential economic development tool. My experience with Genentech, for example, was that they were offered about $50 million more in incentives to go to Dallas and chose to come to Hillsborough instead because the Portland area was a vibrant, vital place to live. A lot of that has to do with the amount of attention and energy we put into our urban planning. And much of that has to do with the ability to do an urban growth boundary that extends to the entire region. If you have an individual city urban growth boundary expansion, then what you have is every city expands based to meet what they perceive as the needs in that particular city, and then we basically have no urban growth boundary. So if you are going to have an urban growth boundary in an area like the Portland metropolitan area, it has to be a region-wide.
Good wrap-up.
Yep, I will just quickly, one quick correction to Representative Sheehan. With all due respect, Metro is not the only regional government in the United States. It simply is the only elected regional government in the United States. And I think that it is that elected quality to us that suggests that much of what Metro does is with the blessings of the public in the region.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in the interest of time, I won't testify. Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. But I will distribute, as I leave, some material that was released at the end of last summer that kind of summarizes some of Metro's recent work in collaboration with the rest of the region.
Thank you very much for that concern for our agenda.
Thank you, Mr.
Time. Thank you. Robert Powell, Jim McCarthy, I think, and Steve Schopp.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I only have enough copies of this for the committee, but it's on our website. I wanted to mention to everybody else.
Thank you.
Co-chair Menz and Co-Chair Reed, Representative Byer, Sheehan, Lindsay, Nathanson, Smith, and Widener. My name's Lieutenant Robert Powell from Oregon City, and I was chairman of the Chamber of Commerce when this experiment started in the Oregon legislature. And I think the history of Metro, while interesting, has essentially been a failure, to tell you the truth, because I think there's been a tremendous amount of money spent on a process that just increased another layer of bureaucracy. And I came from a military with a flatline approach to authority, and we were required to act upon our own. And as an appraiser for a savings and loan, the fee simple title to your property by the Constitution does not allow for the encroachment of Metro-type situations. The American Planning Association wants a cookie-cutter approach to the United States based on a European model, and it should be investigated. And I personally think the fact that this committee is even approaching a conversation on this is a stunning position to be in, because Metro, quite frankly, absorbs a tremendous amount of money, and as an experiment, it was expected to be a model for the rest of the United States, and frankly, on occasion, experiments fail. The problem is we keep pounding our head against the wall.
If I could have you wrap up, because I want to get four more people in. I really appreciate your testimony. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Yes, please go ahead.
For the record, Jim McCauley, I'll improve on my handwriting, Chair Bence, representing Washington County. Real quick, we're in opposition to the bill. I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail, but a hat that I no longer wear, I used to work for HBA of Metro Portland, and at the time I came in, we, like many other organizations in the metro area, were struggling with Metro, looking for ways to try to improve a collaborative effort, try to improve the partnership, and also try to improve some of the visioning work. At that point in time, we actually brought a Metro staff person physically in the building, and that person is actually still there today, trying to continue on with that type of partnership. Now, as Washington County, we've been through this process for the last, urban reserve process for the last several years. We've reached an MOA agreement and would like to continue on that type of relationship into the future. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schott.
My name is Steve Schott. I live in Tualatin. I ran for Metro and narrowly was defeated in 2004. I've been following their process and their trajectory ever since. It's a totalitarian regime now. I'll use those words because it's accurate. They might as well be the City Council of Portland running the entire region. And demonstrative of that is the fact that Michael Jordan, former COO of Metro, is now virtually the head of every agency in the state. Len Peterson, former Metro employee, is now the right-hand person with Governor Kitzhaber. Recently, the JPACT part of Metro, and including with Metro, has redefined the use of federal flex funds to be distributed around the region, with their number one concern being environmental justice. And in application for funding for these infrastructure dollars, and all those flex dollars, $24 million a cycle, are completely fungible and can be used for road maintenance and other vital needs in the infrastructure arena. Many of those projects, roads and other needed needs, were not funded. Instead, bike paths and those sort of things were. But getting to the urban road boundary, it's been used as a barricade to development ever since maybe going back to 98 and 2002 and 2004, when thousands of acres were brought into UGB but left under the constraints of development planning that can't take place. And the reason it hasn't been taking place over the years, we've been told that, well, there's no money for it. Over and over again, even though we have this other layer of government called Metro to fund the development, there was never any money for it. So in 2006, the Homeowners Association was convinced to join Metro in creating the new construction excise tax. This money was due to sunset once they got $6 million or a period of years. That money was to be spent on planning for the urban growth boundary expansion areas to allow industry, jobs, and housing to be built.
Mr. Schaff, if you could, I'm so sorry to have to do this.
I'll have to finish this part. In 2009, Metro extended the excise tax and took all the proceeds to put towards South Waterfront, Milwaukee Light Rail, and the rest of their transit-oriented development projects, betraying the Homeowners Association and the urban growth boundary. So you can see what the trajectory is. They're going to continue to raid money and spend it inappropriately the way Portland wants it spent.
Thank you. Thank you all. And I have two witnesses left signed up, Paul Sabas and Ed Tromke. Thank you for your patience.
I'll defer to Commissioner Sabas. Hi.
Chair Bence, committee members, thank you. I just learned of this bill here a couple days ago. I was intrigued by the sentence of Section 1. And since then, our Clackamas County Board of Commissioners have submitted a letter in opposition to HB 3438. I'm here today signed up as neutral. I'm representing myself as a county commissioner.
Paul, will you please identify yourself?
Pardon?
Will you please identify yourself?
Paul Sabas, Clackamas County Commissioner. Point of being here today is I come in here with a different angle, a different approach on this. I think that a dialogue would be healthy, but I am kind of concerned about opening up a Pandora's box based on the testimony I've heard thus far. My concern or reason for being here today, I happen to be at a meeting this morning in Portland based on the greater Portland-Vancouver region indicators. And as some of you know or have been watching the Oregon State benchmarks and reviewed those over the years, you'll recognize that our economics situation has really been in decline far before the 07 crash. I've been a small business owner for my virtually entire life, and I have been able to work with and presently represent a number of businesses in Clackamas County. A recurring theme, the difficulty and the stifling of some of the regulations, some of the codes, the violations, everything it takes to get a permit to do economic development, whether it's expanding an existing business, growing a new business, or whatnot. I do believe a conversation is in order. I'm hoping maybe an opportunity might arise in the near future where we can perhaps monitor somehow or maybe ask our planning departments in all the cities and the counties and special districts to maybe track all the permits, the people that apply or attempt to apply, and keep those and record those and perhaps compare those against those that were not pursued. Basically to represent how many people have been turned away or felt that it was too difficult to achieve or make their project whole.
Commissioner, we appreciate your being here. Do you have a moment to take a moment to wrap up?
I believe that covers what I'd like to say. So I really appreciate the dialogue and maybe the opportunities again to get that tracking.
Thank you.
Thank you for your patience, and I'll get out of here, let you get out of here quickly. My name is Ed Trumpke. I'm a Clackamas County resident, and I'm here on my own behalf. That said, I did help as an attorney to form the City of Damascus, also the City of Lapine. My firm represents Damascus, West Lynn, Tigard, Milwaukee, a number of cities, King City in the metro area and outside the metro area. I've also served as a former president of the Westside Economic Alliance. I'm currently on the board, which Tom Hughes, President Hughes, used to be on, worked very well with him. He's a great man, and I believe he is bringing a new sense of sharing authority and power to Metro. We look forward to working with him on that. The real reason I'm here is because I'm writing a book on the Oregon Constitution. Oxford University Press is supposed to have it out later this year or the end of the year, and there are three constitutional provisions that work very poorly together. They are the home rule of the metro, home rule of the counties, home rule of the cities. Then those permit the cities, counties, and metro to take authority by charter and by ordinances. There's really not a great deal of collaboration among them to divide up consistently who does what, who pays for what. There's authority on one side, responsibility to pay for things on the other. And I would ask that this committee, if they adopt anything out of this bill, to put together a group, funded or unfunded, to report back in 1 or 2 years on where to draw those lines, how to make the groups work together and be more consistent.
Thank you very much for that. I was afraid you were going to launch into a constitutional, but I thank you for not doing so. Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3438. And Zach, we're now going to do a bunch of things that are very important, so let's go through them. We're going to carry over the work sessions on House Bill 3345. I'm going to check them off as we go. House Bill, we're going to carry over the work session on House Bill 2370. Carry over the work session on House Bill 3113.
I just want to make a small correction. It's the public hearing on 2370.
Carry over the public hearing on 2370. Thank you. Carry over the work session on 3113. Carry over the work session on House Bill 3438. Carry over the work session on House Bill 3377. Carry over the work session on House Bill 3072. And I think, we'll carry over the work session. I'm sorry, yes, carry over the bill, I think, on 3483. Let me see if that's right. The public hearing. Go ahead and tell me what we need to say.
That's perfect. And then we'll need to carry over the public hearings on 3377, 3072, and 3483.
And we'll carry over the public hearings on 3377, 3072, and 3483.
Perfect.
Is there anything else we need to say?
No, sir.
All right. This will be close the carryover portion of this. And is there anything further, members of the committee? Seeing nothing, we're sure we're done.
Down.
Okay. We're adjourned.
Thank you.